subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin this week. How are you doing, Martin?
Hey, not too bad, Chris. How are you?
Good, thanks. Not blown away?
No, that storm Kiara just blew our wheelie bin around, but not too much.
Okay, sounds good. Not too bad. Excellent. Okay, this week we've got two guests. We've got Gary Breda and we've got Diane Clay, both from Hitachi Vantara. Would you like to go ahead and introduce yourselves?
Sure. It's nice to be with you, Chris and Martin. Thanks for inviting us. My name is Gary Breder. I'm the Director of Product Marketing for our Cloud and Services and Solutions part of our business. And with me today is Diane, who manages part of that portfolio. Diane?
Hi. Again, thank you for having us on. We are excited to be here. I'm the Senior Product Marketing Manager for our as-a-service offerings. And so I'm very excited to share that with you all today.
Okay, brilliant. Well, that's a great little sort of run into the title for at least for the topic of this discussion today. And that's to talk about as a service models. Now, Gary, you and I caught up with each other at Next last year in October. And we did have a chat about this, but we didn't get around to actually recording anything at the time, I think because of schedules and so on. But we did talk about the idea of the fact that lots of people are moving towards as a service models. And that's, I think, quite an interesting sort of development in the industry.
Yeah, there's a huge excitement and interest about these pay-per-use and as-a-service models. And the there's a lot of different types of contracts out there that add to the options that we all used to have, conventional purchase or lease. Those two ways of acquiring storage capacity, for example, are in some cases still the best way to do it. But I think that everyone wants to understand what's available now in these new financial instruments and managed services contracts that to know when they should use them and when they should continue to buy in the traditional way.
Okay, let's talk about how people did buy in the traditional way, what they used to do previously, because from my experience, mostly, I guess, in the companies that I worked within, it typically tended to be that we would either buy outright or we would effectively lease the equipment. So we'd buy it, but we'd lease it through somebody else. But, you know, there's lots of different ways people can do this. There's straightforward CapEx like that. There could be a managed service offering. And now, as a service, is possibly slightly different. Do you want to sort of set the scene on what people used to do?
Sure. Well, those are probably the two extremes, is purchase outright versus an as-a-service offering. When we buy anything on an as-a-service offering, storage as a service, for example, we're just having access to that storage. We know that that someone on the other end is managing that storage capacity. We know it's real storage someplace at the end of that URL. They're managing it and handling the capacity management and the availability, and they're running that physical storage equipment. But we don't have to worry about that. Those are probably the two extremes between the conventional purchase, where we had the responsibility, if we were the customer, to in buying that storage, we had to manage that storage and we had to do the capacity planning and ensure that the service levels were met. And now there's these, not only these two extremes, but there's a lot of choice in between. So pay-per-use contracts are now pretty popular as an alternative way to buy storage. So instead of buying it outright and managing it myself as I've done in the past, or lease it, now I have the ability to put a pay-per-use contract in place for that particular asset. Now that means that storage device is still installed in my data center and I still run and manage that storage device as I always have, but I'm only paying for the portion that I'm actually using. And in some cases, that can be a big advantage, while in other cases, it can be still more affordable if I just buy the storage outright. And then that other extreme of buying that fully managed service of an as-a-service offering can be the most cost-effective way to get the service levels that the business needs on day one. So it really becomes situational.
Okay, we'll come back and look at some of those details in a second. But I just wanted to ask you, Martin, you know, from your perspective, I would imagine you probably had a similar experience to me in the sense that most of the time you would take the technology and just manage it yourself. So that would mean planning, deployment, configuration, installation, and then the ongoing support of that yourself. Do you see that as the common way that people are deploying stuff still today?
I still think that's the most common deployment model in a large digital enterprise. Any company which is over about 20 years old, I suspect, will be deploying in that sort of way for a reasonable size. Most of the time, the deployment model, certainly if it's for financial instruments, are not driven by the IT team. Most of the time, as far as I know, they tend to be driven by the finance teams, the corporate finance guys. But yeah, we still manage our storage in a very traditional way. But we don't buy these things as a service, not for anything which is on-premises anyway.
Okay.
So, Chris, would you mind if I ask Martin a few questions there?
Yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
So Martin, the kind of... The way you've described this is that, a company that exists, a fairly large company, it's been around for 20 years or so, established, well-established data center, well-established practices. You know, there's not a whole lot of new things happening. You're right. That's a classic example of, if I need additional capacity, there's no sense buying it in a different way. I'm just adding to the pool I already have, and I'm not hiring new storage admins. I'm using the storage admins that I have, and I'm not trying to rethink how I do capacity planning and how I do the deployment. Those things are pretty much all sorted out, and it's just kind of rinse, rather, and repeat. But even for those well-established companies, sometimes they have a new division or a new project, a new part of the business, a new suite of IT applications that are being deployed, and they need a new team. It's not adding to an existing pool, but it's a new deployment. And so sometimes in that case, it's new enough to that well-established company where they do seek out some of these alternatives.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, we've seen new teams deploy into public cloud, so that's a very different deployment model. I think that a lot of companies at the moment now still think of they'll have a different. So we'll have cloud native applications which we'll be thinking about deploying into the public right. cloud, and they'll accept that model, or it's kind of understood. Bringing that model into an on-premises situation, more traditional enterprise data centers, bring it into your own data centers. I'm sure there are companies which do it. I suggest that they're mostly outliers at the moment. Maybe it will become more common, but at the moment, if I look at the company I work for and talking to my peers, that's a relatively unusual step to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you probably have, I'll go out on a limb here. I don't know what the answer is, but a well-established firm with long practice of having their own data center, there probably is some use of public cloud, yes?
Yeah. Any company of any reasonable size these days will be using public cloud, yeah.
So I think that that's where we are as people look at what these new choices are. Because they are new, people are kind of grappling with what's the best way to use them. I think that the answer will probably end up being that where it's appropriate, we will continue to buy or lease storage and run it in the traditional way. But just like public cloud, there are situations where it is... It's more affordable, it's more economical, it's expeditious to deploy public cloud resources instead of private cloud or conventional resources. And the same thing holds true, I think, for these pay-per-use contracts. So I may not want to convert everything, just like I haven't converted everything to public cloud, but I do it very strategically where it makes the most sense. So I think that what we'll see is we'll probably see people saying, well, I have an application that needs capacity. It's a new application. It must stay in my data center. It can't go to public cloud. And yet I don't have any way to predict what its capacity requirements will be. It may vary quite a bit. If I just guess, I may buy too much storage, which would be a waste, or I might buy not enough storage, which will be disruptive and problematic. I wish there was a way to get that same kind of public cloud experience for things that I have to have in the data center that are just as unpredictable. And that's where you start to see things like these pay-per-use contracts and storage as a service really being popular alternatives.
Okay, so let's dig into that in a bit more then, because clearly, first of all, there's a need that you're identifying, you know, different models of consumption in order to allow people to be a bit more flexible in their business. And clearly, they have to be able to spot that and identify that they want that. But deploying on-premises in the same way as we consume something in the cloud isn't as simple. So, for example, in the public cloud, we share the resources. So if Amazon or Azure or whoever it happens to be puts storage into the cloud, that shared resource that can be given to somebody else if we free it up, that just isn't as practical on-prem as it is in the cloud.
Oh, yeah, that's an understatement. Sure. Yeah, you might even say it's impossible. As a matter of fact, it's designed so that we're preventing others from sharing it. And that's the, I think, one of the defining characteristics. So one of the things that we don't want to do is we don't want to recreate the wheel, so to speak. We don't want to create an alternative to public cloud that is in every way identical to public cloud, because public cloud is a wonderful resource and we should use it where and when it should be used. However, there are times when we can't have data that's in a shared resource. By definition, it needs to be in a dedicated resource dedicated to my company, housed within the within my firewall of my company, et cetera, et cetera. And so when that occurs, what I'm looking to do is there are occasions where I'm looking for the storage vendor to step up and say they'll participate with me in that risk of how much storage should be put in place. I'm using storage because it's an easy example to think about. So if I'm not sure whether I'm going to use 2 gigabytes or 3 gigabytes, maybe 4 gigabytes, I should say terabytes. Let's make it make sense. You know, the reality is that normally I might put 5 terabytes on the floor, but if I only end up using 2 terabytes, that's sort of that could be very wasteful. So I'm looking for the storage vendor in this particular case to share some of that risk and say, listen, if you can share that risk, you'll be more motivated to make sure that the scalability is there when it's needed, and you'll find economical ways to ensure that scalability is in place because you're on the hook for making sure that additional capacity is there when I need it, but you're also in charge of making sure it's efficiently deployed, so I'm not paying more than I should.
Yeah, so let me just come back on that though. So in your instance then, how would you do that with your offerings? Because the first most obvious thing to probably bring up there is that the chances are vendors are going to ask for minimum quantities. You're not going to be able to put in an infrastructure that can do 5 terabytes and then have you come back next week and put another 5 terabytes. The chances are there's going to be minimum commit and there's going to be some cost associated with that. So it's not entirely a service in that sense. So how are Hitachi doing it?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So one of the things that we do is we for both the pay-per-use contracts of Hitachi Flex consumption, as well as the as-a-service offerings that we have for storage as a service, that we do establish a minimum contract value. So in my example, if the customer said, I'm not sure whether I'm going to use 2 terabytes, 3 terabytes, 4 terabytes or more, we might look at installing perhaps initially a 4 terabytes, which would put the minimum contract at that 2 terabyte level, just as a easy example. So half of what is installed establishes what that minimum is. Now, if the customer said, well, I think at a minimum, I might be as low as 1, then perhaps we'd look at, is it possible for us to put 2 terabytes on the floor, establishing that 1 terabyte is your minimum? So our interest is to make sure that if there has to be a minimum, as you're saying, we want to make sure that minimum is something that's a threshold that never is in risk of being breached. The only reason it's there is that it's not possible for us to install millions of dollars worth of equipment and have the customer be able to say, oh, we've decided not to use it at all. So it's just something that as long as you're able to use it and, kind of in the kind of rules of fairness, if you're not sure how much you're going to use, we can structure that contract accordingly.
Okay. I'm just bringing you back in again, Martin. I mean, from my perspective, a lot of what we talked about so far is what you might have seen in the classic OpenScale from EMC. It's that traditional, it's always going to grow, so we'll just bring more stuff in, at the last moment when you think you need it. So really in your environment, you've really got to understand your demand there to make good use of that, I think.
It's not that different to dealing with as it is at the moment, you've always got to understand your demand, because it's never quick to put a new device or a new array on anyway. So storage in some ways is great for a vendor, I think, because very few people ever need less storage. The data will always balloon to fill the available storage. So storage as a service, I think vendors, and I'm going to be quite nasty now, is we'll always talk about it being a risk. There's not a huge amount of risk. Somebody will always find something to put on that. So it doesn't matter how large an array you put on and what your base level is, you know the customer's always going to fill it. Or there'll be some project which they haven't planned for, and the storage is on the ground, so they'll use that.
So I think there's one big difference since those early contracts of 10 years ago, and I think that even those other vendors have advanced since then. You had mentioned EMC, yeah. OpenScale. Those were contracts that were shifting the total amount. So basically, if you bought 5 terabytes of storage or 4 terabytes of storage, if we keep the story straight, it was just a way to shift the payment for that 4 terabytes to when you actually got to the point where you used it. And that vendor was banking on the fact that you eventually would use the 4 terabytes. What I'm talking about today and the contracts you'll see today don't require you to ever get to those 4 terabytes. And so there's big differences between the pay-per-use contracts of today versus the ones that maybe you first saw 10 years ago. So unlike those ones of 10 years ago, you eventually would have to use and pay for the 4 terabytes. It was just a question of when. So would you grow into it sooner or grow into it later? That was still a great advantage over the financial instruments of the day. But now these pay-per-use contracts above the minimum are absolutely pay-per-use. So if you only grow to 2.1 terabytes, that's all you ever pay for.
Fair enough. So in terms of that then, how do you manage things like auditing of that? So how do you actually manage the process of making sure that somebody is actually using the stuff they said they're using or that they're not, you know, and making sure that you're not basically being abused there by the customer?
Well, that's sort of the easy part. I think that everyone is familiar with the kind of data that they get from the storage devices that they manage themselves. And we use, you know, the same kind of storage management, storage managers that are equipped with the storage devices that we sell. And then we go one step further and add to that some of the kind of AI and analytics capabilities that we have in something we call Smart Data Center. Now, this is, if you're running your own data center, this is sort of like the Iron Man suit for the IT administrator. It still requires an IT administrator. It's still looking at all the data and feeds from all the devices that are in their data center. It just makes them far more capable, giving them greater insights as to what all that data means. Now, the bigger question generally I get is, does the customer get to see all of those things that we get to see, all those data points, all those recommendations, all the analytics, you know, that's showing us these trends and making these recommendations? And the answer is absolutely yes. It's fully transparent to the customer, to the users, so they can see everything that we're using to run and manage that, in our example, storage device.
Okay, let's move on and think a bit more then about actual as a service. So
yeah,
I would say that if you look at, say, the way that stuff is delivered to you in the public cloud, or the way that you, classic example, buy a mobile phone contract, you are not necessarily bothered about how that service is delivered at the back end. You're more bothered about things like available IOPS or capacity, or on your mobile phone, it'll be that you've got, you know, 100% availability to the network. So how is the model changing as you're moving to your as a service offerings compared to what we've just discussed?
Yeah, I think this is a great question, and this is fundamentally what most people are interested in. And rather than use the mobile phone analogy, let's talk specifics about storage. If I needed additional capacity for my SAP suite of applications that I've been running for the last 20 years and managing that environment myself, I'd probably just go out and buy or lease the storage that I needed to run that environment and add it to the pool that I had. But if I had something new where I was very uncertain about the capacity that I was going to need, then these pay-per-use contracts can be very economical. It can either save me money or help me reduce risk because I don't know yet. Now, I can later convert those over to something that's more traditional. That's a case where I don't know what the capacity is that I need, but I have utmost confidence in the storage admins that I've got in place to run that storage. That's where a pay-per-use contract is perfect. But now let's bring in this idea of storage as a service, where it's being fully managed, and I'm not so much buying capacity, although it's exactly what I'm buying. What I'm also buying is I'm buying a service level commitment or service level guarantee. So what I'm looking for in an as a service, storage as a service, I'm looking for a service catalog of service levels. Let's call them bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. And those definitions I pick from whatever the vendor has available. So they might have, three or four or five, half a dozen choices for each one of the bronze, silver, gold, platinum. And I design that so that it fits the kind of service levels my organization needs. So now I've got that service catalog, and I'm allowing my users to pick from that service catalog the capacity that they need. And I know the vendor is delivering to that SLA, that service level, from day one. Now, that's a case where that would be perfect for a new deployment in perhaps a new group where I don't yet have the staff of storage admins or IT administrators that are experienced in running that environment for that suite of applications, for example. And rather than suffer through a learning curve, it may in some cases be so business critical, I need those service levels guaranteed day one. That's what the business expects from IT. So storage as a service is a great way for IT to simply take that responsibility and transfer it to the vendor who can live up to that responsibility and deliver those service levels from day one. So we're not really talking about a service provider has got better skills than your people have. They just may be more experienced at that, delivering the service levels for that kind of device in that kind of situation. And certainly there's no learning curve for them to move through.
Okay, so if we looked at yours as an example, what do you measure and how do you measure whether those service levels have even been met? And then if you do fail on them, how do you remedy that?
So the service level descriptions would be things like performance and availability, fairly simple and straightforward, but they also include the kind of serviceability of the environment. So you may have, kind of level one, level two calls and different severities. These are all defined, and you as a customer, you would make sure that that scope of service is exactly what matches what your requirements are. So this would be everything from how long does it take to provision capacity once a user selects it? If there's an error warning, how soon before the vendor responds to that and corrects that? How many instances, if any, is there allowed to be like not enough capacity to fill that request? These things are all defined, and just like they would be between IT and the business in defining an SLA type of a contract, that same kind of service level definition and that full scope of all of those things would be included in that service catalog.
Okay, so what have I gained at this point by buying something as a service? Because I guess I could have bought a contract where I could have put some of these things in there already. But as a service says to me, other than provisioning, which if it was in the cloud, it'd be via an API and I'd just go and ask for it and it'd just be made available to me. What else have I got in an as a service on-premises solution that is different than some of the other things we've already discussed?
Let me take that one. That's a great question. One thing, that yes, we have SLAs, but they're guaranteed, and the service credit structure itself, so that if we didn't meet one of those SLAs, that is actually built into the contract, and it's reviewed every month. The other thing, it really all comes down to scope of service. As a service, because we or the vendor is providing that level of service, it's very critical. And so the fact that, and again, it's all guaranteed. So it's, we own and manage all of the service. So I'm going to give you just some examples. For example, SLA-based management, all the event management, incident management, problem management, escalation management, capacity or performance management, access, continuous service improvement, just service management, security management, request fulfillment. So, I could keep going.
Yeah,
but there's,
I think
those
I
are just some of the scopes that we have, criteria based against. And We evaluate them all the time, and that's when you can actually see with our smart data center how we're performing against them. That's more information than most vendors have for them, or most customers have for themselves. So it's the devil's in the details, because at the top it's like your people managing it versus our people managing it. And again, as Gary said, if I am adding 20 terabytes to an existing 200 terabytes because I'm just ex adding more service, and I've got my entire organization that is doing a great job of managing it, you're not going to go to as a service. You're not going to bring in a separate way of managing your storage, in that example. But if you need those guaranteed SLAs day one for a new project or a new data center or, a new environment, this way and there's money on the line that you're going to get those SLAs day one.
Okay, Martin, from your perspective, I think you maybe, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would look at it in, I guess, a scenario where I would say, at what point, where does the line come between what the vendor does and what we do on-prem? Do we let the vendor go almost as far as doing provisioning and almost do nothing ourselves? Or, would we want to get somewhere in between? How would you look at that?
See, at the moment, I'm struggling to see what the difference with between this and a more traditional outsource, where you've outsourced your storage team. It's
Good.
Playing with semantics, really. We say, no, it's for new stuff as opposed to
Yeah.
Existing. So at the moment, it doesn't feel any different to where if we were to go and talk to an outsource partner, they would list all those things which they will provide for us: metrics, measurements, guarantees, SLAs. So at the moment, I don't see the difference between that and a traditional outsource.
That's excellent, Martin. So that you've captured the management part of it. But the challenge is, in the past, if I went to that same outsourcer and said, outsourcer, I'd like to have you do all of these tasks, including, manage that upgrade is totally non-disruptive. If more capacity has to be added, I want you to worry about it. And look, they're all in on that, because that's what they've decided to be their expertise, and they've staffed up and trained for it, and they're spreading that expertise, that management expertise, across many different customers. Although they're not spreading the capacity, not shared capacity, but the expensive IT management part is being shared, that intellectual property. What they won't do as an outsourcer is they won't take the gamble and say, wait a minute, Martin, you're telling me you only have a rough, vague idea of how much capacity you're going to use and how much I should put in place, and you want me to take the risk of putting in place 4 or 5 terabytes when, in fact, you may only use 2 or 2.5. I'm sorry, but I don't work that way. I'd be glad to do the management and probably save a lot more money than it would cost you to do the management piece. Now, that's could be your mileages vary. Sometimes there's customers that do a better job of the outsourcers, but in a lot of cases, there is a considerable savings there. But usually the hosting company, the outsourcer, won't provide that pay-per-use portion of it. And so if you combine those two, now you're getting the essence of what it's like to have these on-prem storage as a service.
Yeah, I'm still not sold, Gary. It's interesting listening to this at the moment. It doesn't feel like something which particularly works, in my experience. I have seen similar contracts to this. I've seen
Okay.
outsourcers do or and try to do similar things. It seems to go wrong about year four.
And tell me what I, because I think I know what the answer to this question is. Tell me what happens in year four.
Year four, there's obviously you start looking at the service which has been provided. You start whether we have seen growth, and then suddenly you either see a ramp up in cost, or you see there's often you see expertise drifting off accounts, the internal expertise from a service provider. So there seems to be a lack of care at that point, and then the problem you then you have a very long exec. And that's always the issue with a lot of these things. It's the exit can often be expensive for the customer, and it takes an extremely long time. I'm sure you've experienced that as well, Chris.
Yeah, I guess I can see what Martin's saying, that you take a service on, and then the vendor gets maybe comfortable with the service, and then you ha and doesn't quite deliver it to the same degree as they did when they were keen day one. And certainly getting off an environment, if it's grown significantly, can be quite a cost. So I guess it's down to the responsibility of making sure you've got the right terms and conditions built into that contract from day one.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I'd like to say that in almost all cases, when we have expertly managed storage environments and a very skilled IT administrator staff, storage as a service is almost never the choice. So it's a very common reaction that Martin has to say, man, I don't see it. It's not for me. That's perfect. But this is different than a hosted service in a number of different ways. Just like that storage as a service that I get from one of the big public cloud providers, and we all know who they are, you don't have that problem after the fourth year where all of a sudden the device has to be upgraded or there is a dedicated staff to that device that is no longer as enthusiastic about delivering those service levels. In public cloud, it is a very constant, a rate card of service levels that are guaranteed, and it's just about those services. What's behind it and what's powering that rate card and those service levels, the vendor, public cloud provider, is changing the technology perhaps month by month, year by year. They're changing the technology to be able to deliver that. And so it helps them bring costs down. And that's what we see in the public cloud. We see costs decline, not increase. And the same is true in these storage as a service when we do them on-prem, because we're doing them in the same way. We're just deploying that dedicated resource in the customer's data center. Now, you're right to say that requires us to have a minimum commitment in the contract. But other than that, the experience is very similar to that public cloud experience, where we have a published rate card. So if, you know, as we get more efficient and the management of that storage gets more efficient and the storage device gets more economical to deliver capacities, the prices on those rate cards decline over time, just as they do in public cloud. So it's the opposite of these hosted experiences that you're talking about.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, so let's sort of wrap up and come towards the end and talk about what the different types of services that you might see in the data center these days, and that, you know, if they're hard or easy to deliver. We talked a lot about storage. So storage seems like a really easy one because, in general, you're putting in technology that grows over time. It's quite sticky. People don't move their data off very, very frequently. But as an example, you already offer data protection as a service. That one, to me, seems like a challenge to deliver because there's a lot more service level and operational focus around that.
Actually, we see that as just as simple, if not simpler, than the storage as a service. So our data protection as a service is provided standard, is just simply a backup service, so that in the fully managed storage as a service, we're fully managed storage. This is fully managed data protection. And like I said, backup is standard, and you can add to that remote replication. Now, this doesn't include the capacities. This is just simply the management and ensuring that the data is backed up based on the service levels and the recovery times. Are, you know, RTO and RPO are specified so that you can have different levels at different costs off a rate card, same idea. And we would expect that rate card to go down as efficiencies are gained. And as it goes down, that's something that all customers enjoy.
Just to touch on that in a bit more detail, Gary, who would look after things like ensuring that everything is backed up? So, for instance, if the customer creates 100 new virtual machines one day, whose responsibility does it lie to make sure those have been added to the backup environment and make sure that those backups then are successful every day from that point onwards?
It's the responsibility of the vendor that's providing the backup as a service, or the data protection as a service, to protect anything within the confines of that contract. So, for example, the contract might say that any data that's in a particular storage device or in a collection of a pool of storage, if it's there, it needs to be backed up. Most customers don't have the same service levels for all data types. So they're not going to protect their customer records at the same level they're going to protect their, you know, kind of the DevOps test data, for example, or, you know, things like that. So you're looking at two dimensions, what pool is included and at what service level is determined. So most customers would set it up so that there would be a minimum service level for all data. So if the user forgot to declare what the service level is, it would default to something. Now, we can make that default something in the middle. We can make it most aggressive. We can make it all the way at the bottom. It depends on what the customer prefers as their default.
Okay, you pick that up. That makes sense.
This whole area of financial operations seems to be, because this is where we end up into. This isn't a technical discussion at all, really. There's financial operations, and it allows us to move into more into an activity-based costing model, which is where all these services should eventually take us. But
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a long journey for most organizations at the moment.
Yeah, and this is why we see such diversity. So like I said in the beginning, there's a great deal of interest by everyone who's in the market to buy storage or buy protection or buy whatever. There's a great deal of interest in these new forms of acquisition contracts. However, there's still the majority of people who continue to buy or lease in that traditional way. They're less frequent are those people who say, you know, I want to hire the staff that's expert on my business and expert at how the applications support that business process, but I don't see storage admins or server admins or backup administrators as being strategic. You know, if that's a way where I can get the service levels that the business needs and do that in an economical way, I'm just going to go that route. And that's almost that default, you know, cloud first type of mentality. Why should I do it myself if I can just do it from the cloud? And this is the answer of, okay, I can't move these things to the cloud, but why should I staff up the experts when I can just get somebody else to do it for me and provide the guarantees? I can shift my IT focus and staff on the more strategic elements. So you do have more and more people kind of thinking along those lines, but admittedly, you still have a lot of people saying, something interesting to consider. For now, I'm going to continue to buy or purchase lease the way I have been.
So Gary, it sounds like what we're saying is that, you know, this is another offering. It's part of a portfolio of offerings that you might want to offer customers, which might include all the other services we have, but it's going to be a bit of time as people decide to look at their business and migrate towards that and adapt what they're doing today. Would you think that's a fair summary?
Yes, I think that this is, number one, this is a financial type of a decision, just like finance drives initially a cloud decision. But I think secondarily after that, it becomes a decision of, do I have the confidence in the service levels that my team can provide, and or do I have higher confidence if a vendor is providing guaranteed service levels? So it kind of starts off at cost, and I think it looks at kind of risk and flexibility after that, just like it does with a public cloud decision.
Okay, so if people want to go and find out more about how Hitachi Vantara are doing this, is there a specific part of the website they should go to? Where would you like to direct people?
Diane?
HitachiVantara.com, and if you look under service offerings,
okay,
you'll find us. It's both under service offerings and under products.
Great. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. But for now, Gary, Diane, thank you for joining us, and look forward to catching up soon.
Martin and Chris, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.